You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on August 24th, 2014 from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Persephone joins me to discuss entrepreneurialism and regulation, as well as the U.S. stance on Syria. Then, we interview freelance writer Jamie Nesbitt Golden on Witnessing Ferguson. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
I want to talk about another big idea. This one's not so much about American governance reform, which most of the other ones have been. This is a little bit further afield. It's more of an economic reform, although obviously that does involve kind of the government at some level. There's a lot of talk about millennials and startups and how many millennials want to start their own businesses, even if they remain a small business and don't become, you know, some huge Silicon Valley thing, you know, like Facebook or whatever. A lot of millennials want to start their own business. Whether it's that they have a cool idea or they just are having trouble finding work through the conventional means, or they're just recognizing these new economic realities that we've been talking about a lot on Arsenal for Democracy. What happens when there's a lot more automation, things like that? What happens when the, you know, older folks are retiring later? So there's, just to give an example here, there was a poll that was conducted by Lake Research Partners and Bellwether Research. They polled 872 millennials. This article from entrepreneurship.org was reporting on the polling results here. 54% of the nation's millennials either want to start a business or already have started one. And then they mentioned that specifically there's an even higher percentage among young people of color. They said 64% of Latinos and 63% of African Americans were interested in starting their own companies. And some of that is, again, a necessity issue that there aren't as many opportunities available for them, especially as their white peers. But also it's probably, I would imagine, a desire to start, you know, their own economic engines in their own communities, because that's something that's been criticized a lot with good reason. Over many years, this idea that there was a period where you had flourishing black neighborhoods with black businesses, and to some extent the same thing with Latinos, and then that sort of went by the wayside between factors like desegregation and gentrification and things like that. You know, in Newark, Delaware, for example, where this show is broadcast from, there was a large historically black neighborhood, and most of that has now been kind of taken over by the off-campus housing of the college, but it was already going by the wayside before because of various economic pressures and other things moving into the areas. Obviously, that's one very small piece of the puzzle of the kind of economic development debates in Newark, but that's just to give an example of a scenario where that's happened. So in response, you can see why there might be a new surge now for similar businesses. I'm very sympathetic to this position. I'm somebody who's, you know, kind of doing my own thing as well, although I'm also working part-time for a company that I did not start, somebody else's company. But this idea is certainly very appealing to me, and I think it's appealing for a lot of people in our generation. However, I think that there's some folks that are kind of co-opting that, whether they're cynical older people that are trying to exploit the enthusiasm of these, you know, young folks who want to start their own thing, and then they're just using it for their own ends, or whether they're, more troublingly from my perspective, they're from these sort of libertarian and, you know, big business conservative groups. We've seen a lot of that where they campaign on saying young people want to be entrepreneurs, and the thing standing in the way of entrepreneurialism is big regulations from the government. Well, I mean, it's rarely that simple. But it's especially pernicious, I think, that the focus has been on this idea that the only thing holding back these young people from starting their own businesses are these onerous regulations. That's how it's always phrased, is that it's onerous regulations, as if these regulations were dropped down by the capricious bureaucrats of the sky with no regard to how it would affect anything and that it wasn't in response to anything. The reality of the situation is that most regulations are enacted, maybe they're not the, you know, perfect solution, but they're enacted in response to existing problems in the system. A lot of the folks that are pushing that agenda don't agree with that solution, but that's really the reality of the situation. And I think it's hard to argue that that's how most of them have at least come into play, whether or not you think that's the appropriate response. If you want to go back to the turn of the previous century, there was that whole wave during the Teddy Roosevelt administration of putting in regulations for things like food safety and meat inspections. Why? Because they're publishing books like The Jungle, where talking about meatpacking factories where people falling into the grinders and stuff. There was just a general lack of any kind of safety or oversight whatsoever. And that kind of just goes to show that these regulations may seem arbitrary now, significantly removed from the problems, but as often happens, they're there for a reason. Maybe there's a workplace regulation or something that's meant to keep workers safe because there was a fire that killed a lot of people. And we look at other countries that don't have these regulations, like that big Bangladesh factory fire, and we see there that had these regulations been in place and enforced, it's always important to look at the enforcement side too, that some of these tragedies could have been avoided. So this push to try to hijack the entrepreneurial spirit of millennials and get them on board with deregulation of various things, it's a cynical ploy to get rid of regulations that these companies don't like. And it's not necessarily actually going to help because most of these regulations don't really affect genuinely small businesses all that much. And if you get to be scaled up or you become part of some larger enterprise, then, you know, it starts becoming more important because those factors that are being met by these regulations come into play more. And that brings us to this topic that I think we're going to talk about today, kind of this so-called sharing economy. And, you know, we're not talking about Burning Man here or whatever, but, you know, your Ubers and UberX and your Lyfts and your Airbnbs and all the various competitors. Those are kind of the biggest name brands in the game at this point in the United States and various other countries, but there's obviously a lot of these companies that have sprung up. And this gets into a lot of regulatory issues and things like that. And the instinct has been to kind of rebel against this, I think, but in my opinion, not necessarily with the best thinking through of the implications of that. Persephone, where do you think we should start on this?
Well, I mean, I think that in terms of Uber and Lyft, for instance, there's clearly a convenience thing here. I mean, a lot of people use it. It's easy. It's convenient. But then the big issue is that they're essentially unlicensed taxis. And, you know, there's a reason that we have licenses for taxis, that we have taxi medallions. In the Boston area, there's been a lot of debate about how those medallions get issued and criticisms of corruption in that system. But at the end of the day, when you have unlicensed taxis, then there's also less answerability and it becomes very difficult to control certain things. I mean, for instance, Uber doesn't do drug tests on their drivers and they conceive of themselves, instead of conceiving of themselves as a transportation company, their excuse is, well, we just get people in touch, you know, we just connect people so they're able to exchange services, which again, I mean, it has sort of a libertarian ring to it. This idea of, well, we're just facilitating, you know, these interactions and it's a free market exchange type thing, even though they're still in control, you know, they still control the money and the flow of money. But at the end of the day, whatever they call it, the reality is that they are enabling this exploitation of the system. They're enabling people that have no real taxi experience going and picking people up and driving them places with very little responsibility for doing so.
Right. I think that we both agree, as pretty much, I guess, almost everyone does, that there are definite problems with the conventional cab system as it currently exists. And there are reforms that could and probably should be made to improve those. But from our perspective, this total lack of regulatory oversight becomes a real problem for a whole range of reasons. Obviously, you mentioned the drug tests. And there was a Gawker article that I pulled up talking about how easy it is for these folks to get around the background checks. Maybe it's not Uber itself that's manipulating this. Maybe it's sort of third-party middleman contractors, but that somewhere along the lines, they're sort of skirting the regulations, even the company's own regulations, without even getting into the government side of having any sort of real background checks done or signing people up under fake names that have already been approved because some other driver had a clean record and was okayed to do this. You know, there's a lot of problems with how the taxi court system works. There's a whole, like in New York City, for example, there's a whole like parallel court system for dealing with complaints and things with taxis. And there's a lot of problems. I found a lot of articles about that, of how many problems there are with that and how that can be really unfair to average cab drivers. But to my knowledge, there's not like a system at all in place for having any sort of mediation or anything with Uber drivers. And maybe I'm wrong on this, but again, it gets really hazy as to like who works for whom, who's independent, all that sort of thing. Another example that I think you wanted to talk about is kind of the safety issue. Obviously, you can have safety issues with conventional cab drivers as well, but again, there's at least theoretically some sort of regulatory system in place, and it's probably a lot easier to track down, you know, a cab and figure out who was driving it than with the cars from Uber.
Yes, and there's actually a very interesting article in the Daily Beast regarding this issue where the writer describes her experience of essentially being stalked by an Uber driver who got her name, her full name, from the system because that information was shared with the driver. And that's another issue, too, that you would never have with a taxi. I mean, you might give the person your first name just so that they know who you are, but a situation like that where your personal information, including sometimes your phone number, gets transferred to this person, that's not really a positive situation. There's some safety issues there. I mean, then there's the more straightforward issue of just general sexual assault. I mean, people are using Uber often in vulnerable situations where they feel unsafe, when it's late at night, if they, you know, are in situations where they can't be with friends, things like that, all of which makes it very easy to exploit that situation to commit sexual assault.
And I think there's actually, I don't know if they were specifically with one of these sort of sharing service type things or the Uber and similar competitors, but I think there were some assaults with off-brand, unlicensed livery services in the Boston area, for example. Those made the front page. But that there have been reported situations of these things where now you've kind of gone off the grid into this sort of no man's land of, well, how are we going to track down this car and figure out who was driving it? Because with some of these services, you're actually just driving your own car. Like I think Lyft or maybe one of those other ones is like that, where it's just like, okay, I'm going to go be a fake taxi driver now and drive my own car around. Like, you know, there's no sort of anybody to be accountable to except that individual. And then you've got to track them down somehow and all that kind of thing. And that's a bit worrying. There's another similar situation. I don't know the exact details, but some of the services don't treat these things as the way they would with standard cab fare. There's sort of negotiated rates with some of these companies where you kind of get in the car and say, okay, you know, here's where I'm going. What do you think is fair? And then you kind of have a little mini bidding war and come up with something. And it's probably pretty quick. I don't know. But from what I've heard, you kind of say, okay, yeah, I think that's probably about a $15 ride or something like that. And then they're not even paid as payments. They're like gifts or something like that, which is just a transparently absurd way to get around the taxation issue, which is another thing. And that's going to get into also stuff like Airbnb, where that's an even bigger issue. But this idea of the people not reporting the money that they're making or not treating it as income or saying, oh, well, it's just a gift among friends that I met 5 seconds ago through an internet app, you know, and so it shouldn't count for taxation purposes. That's an especially huge issue with those sort of room renting things. You know, there's been the like New York administration and places like that have been particularly saying like, look, we don't want landlords to be exploiting their, you know, housing to make short-term rentals that get around various housing requirements and things, but especially they don't want these to get around the hotel laws regarding, you know, that hotels have to pay certain taxes to the local communities and things like that. And companies like Airbnb say, oh, well, you know, it's cheaper to rent in these places, so these people tend to stay longer. So, you know, they'll go to Paris for 5 days instead of 3 days because it costs less to stay. And, you know, that's great for the local economy, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's hard to measure. Whereas what you can definitely measure is that there's not tax being paid. And one of the articles that I was reading suggested that there may be, you know, it may be as low as 0% of these people, unless there's an explicit arrangement in some communities, maybe 0% of the people renting out their places are actually paying the equivalent of a hotel tax. And, you know, I'm sure that the anti-tax crowd is going to be like, good, get rid of more taxes. But like, again, the taxes, like the regulations, they exist for a reason. You may disagree, but they're there for a reason, even if you don't like the reason. And they're paying for various things. And if you just have these sort of rogue off-brand hotels that aren't operating as hotels, you know, but are just, oh, it's a three-day rental or something, like that's creating a whole raft of problems where the city's then not collecting on those taxes and they're going to have to make up the revenue shortfall somewhere else. But, you know, I'm especially just really concerned about that kind of skirting taxes angle that applies to all these kind of things and to some extent the regulations as well. I mean, one of the reasons that hotels cost like maybe a third or more higher than these things is because the hotels have to do all these inspections, safety inspections, make sure there's not fire hazards, make sure you're not going to, you know, die in your sleep or whatever for some reason. All these sort of things that aren't going to be checked by any city inspectors or even probably the people renting it out, that's really scary to me. I think people just aren't thinking about it or they're saying, oh, well, that can't happen to me. But it's like, again, these regulations exist for a reason. They aren't just capricious.
I think that the argument that services like Airbnb would make is that, well, that's consumers' choice to overlook that. But I think that the whole reason that we have these regulations is that people make bad decisions, and those bad decisions don't only have an impact on them. For instance, if there's some fire safety problem and, you know, somebody tries to cook something in the microwave and the microwave explodes and there's a fire, that's not just going to affect the building. I mean, if the building burns down and the fire doesn't spread, that's still going to bring down property values. If it does spread, then you're going to have a neighborhood up in smoke because of some non-regulated hotel.
Right. I mean, I've lived in unsatisfactory apartments and stuff before. Some of them, you know, maybe didn't have the greatest fire detection stuff or sprinkler systems or whatever. You know, what if somebody that you rent it out, you go away for the weekend or whatever, and then something catches on fire, even if, like you said, even if it doesn't spread to any other buildings, if it spreads outside the apartment, what if you're the only person who was renting out for extra cash? Now you've gotten the entire building torched and just ruined everything for all the other residents of the building. Whereas like a hotel, that's not people's homes for the most part. If there's a fire in the hotel, that's potentially very dangerous and causes various damage for the hotel, but you're not ruining everyone else's life around you because of some bad decision or accident that happened. And again, a lot of this can be perfectly unintentional, but it's these unintentional consequences. And so, you know, I'm very pro entrepreneurialism and millennials, you know, coming up with cool ideas and stuff like that. And I also agree with that certain things need to be reformed and potentially made more affordable. But, you know, there's a way of going about it and there's a way of not going about it. And when you got like the CEO of Uber, the founder there, you know, being a Fountainhead fan and stuff, and an Ayn Rand guy, you know, that starts to raise red flags for me. It's like, well, what's the agenda here? Is the agenda to provide better services for people at lower costs? Or is the agenda to, you know, subvert regulatory frameworks and tax regimes and things like that? And, you know, again, these things aren't arbitrary. They don't come out of nowhere. So eventually it's going to have effects on the people around you or the governments around you. And to me, that's really worrying. So I think there's something to be cautious about and keep in mind, certainly.
I absolutely agree.
All right. Well, Arsenal for Democracy will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Persephone. We're going to talk now about the situation in Syria and Iraq. Obviously, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The media has been calling it Islamic State. I think I stated my position previously was that I wasn't going to call them that because I think that's really silly to just suddenly call them Islamic State because they want to be called that. But either way, they've really kind of merged the conflicts in northern Iraq and in Syria. But the focus now seems to be shifting a bit more to Syria, obviously because of the, probably in part, large part because of the beheading of the American journalist in Syria. Personally, as horrible as that was, I don't think that should really be a catalyst for more action one way or the other. Things should be a little bit more significant than that to override the various strategic imperatives against getting more involved in the situation in Syria. But there's been a lot of developments in Syria besides that in the last several weeks, and with regard to Syria on the side of the U.S. in Washington. And so that's something we should look at. Just to remind everyone, we're recording this on the night of Sunday, August 24th. So the situation may have changed because, according to a Guardian article that came out shortly before we were recording this, the U.S. is apparently very strongly considering airstrikes in Syria now, and that may have happened by the time this show airs on Wednesday and is released online. But at the time that we're recording this, that had not happened yet, although I had been kind of predicting that we might be heading in that direction for the past week or so. So the situation in Syria essentially is, I would say, twofold. There was effectively for the past year or so, a three-way civil war between the government, the regime in Damascus, following Bashar al-Assad, supported by Hezbollah, the quote-unquote Free Syrian Army, the sort of rebel coalition that had originally rebelled back in 2011, that has been fighting the war since then, and that's not going very well for them. And they're the ones that are sort of supported by the U.S., and there's various other kind of loosely aligned factions. And then there's like Syrian Kurds, but they're kind of just doing their own thing, as often happens with, you know, Kurdish operations during a period of unrest like this. And then there's the ISIS forces in eastern Syria who've been growing in strength. Now, the Wall Street Journal actually did a very interesting in-depth report. They said they pieced together this account, quote, from interviews with Syrian rebel commanders and opposition figures, Iraqi government officials and Western diplomats, as well as Al-Qaeda documents seized by the U.S. military in Iraq. And they also interviewed various, like, you know, Syrian officials in Lebanon and various other surrounding countries, the people who are more accessible to the for comment on the how the government's position has changed or whatever in the war. So essentially the accusation is that the Assad regime has gone very easy on ISIS to the point of at certain times actively opening up corridors for ISIS forces to move through so that they can go attack the Free Syrian Army, the FSA forces. Basically anybody that the U.S. is supporting or that anybody other than ISIS that's fighting against the regime, they have enabled that. And they've also had, allegedly, a catch-and-release policy. They deny this, certainly. They say it's amnesty and goodwill gestures or whatever, but the Iraqi government has complained periodically that they essentially, any time a jihadist fighter from another country landed at the airport in Damascus, which, what a way to make an entrance into the civil war, they basically, you know, swept them up in their drag nets if they figured out that they were a jihadist coming in, which was probably pretty easy to figure out if they were a foreign person coming into Damascus in the middle of the civil war. And they just simply said, are you here to fight the Syrian government or are you here to fight literally anybody else? And especially, are you here to fight the U.S. forces in Iraq? That was especially true in the early phases, but then the U.S. started pulling out. But basically, U.S. interests in Iraq, the Kurds, for example. And if they said that they were not there to fight the Syrian regime, they were simply let go into the Syrian countryside. And off they went, traveling along the various highways. And, you know, the Iraqi government was like, why are there thousands of fighters pouring across the border from Syria? Because nominally, the Iraqi government under Maliki was pretty friendly toward the Assad government in Damascus in Syria. So the question was, why were they doing this to basically undermine the, you know, central Iraqi control? But the according to this Wall Street Journal report, the Assad regime's strategic decision was, we can probably take ISIS if we let them build up in exchange for hammering away at the people that we're most concerned with. Essentially, they let Eastern Syria, which they don't really care about either way, go to ISIS. And then they said, as long as you're fighting the opposition forces that are backed by the US and Turkey and all those other countries, if you fight them, that makes our job easier in Western Syria and we'll deal with you later. And so we're reaching a pivot point, apparently, where according to one of the most interesting quotes from an Iraqi government official who was very sympathetic to the Syrian regime, they said, Damascus is asking the world to help and the world can't say no, which is that they've basically beaten back the forces that are supported by the United States. I described this as a bit like watching the Battle of Stalingrad if the Nazis were winning instead of the Soviets, which is that they're going like literally block by block through every city that was held by the rebels, and they are taking it in as many days or weeks as it takes. They've got airstrikes on specific buildings. They've got artillery fire. They've got missiles. Last year, we saw them use chemical weapons. They are just going through by any means necessary and taking out these cities and towns, no matter how many residents die, because they do not care. They're waging a sectarian war to support a minority regime. The more people from the majority they kill, the better off they're doing, essentially, which is a pretty harsh way of counting it, but that's how they're doing it. And from a sort of just a purely strategic sense, that's working out pretty well. So the rebels have fallen back at this point to basically one city, Aleppo, that they've held since almost the beginning of the war, and then a few other smaller ones that are going to fall very quickly. And now the Syrian government is pivoting toward ISIS. Now that everyone else is against ISIS, you've got the United States, you've got Turkey, you've got the Kurds, you've got the central government in Baghdad, you've got, you know, even the Saudis are a little bit freaked out. You've got, you know, Iran, which is a supporter of the Syrian government that doesn't like ISIS. You've got Lebanon, which always has a tense relationship with Syria, going up against ISIS. At this point, everybody's lined up against ISIS, even if they're not working together actively. And then the Assad regime says, okay, now we're going to war with ISIS. They've started airstrikes. Apparently, they did like 36 or something in the past several weeks on the quote-unquote capital of the Islamic State in Raqqa. And then we've now seen that the ISIS forces are going up directly against the Syrian government. So the Syrian government's position is either you can help us or you can get out of the way. So that's their perspective on the situation. The U.S. has been very opposed to the Syrian government, doesn't really want to get involved in this situation, or didn't until this past week. And then last weekend, we saw some reports from the Free Syrian Army folks saying, oh, the United States asked us to go make a television statement requesting U.S. airstrikes. And I initially was like, well, that seems kind of crazy. I don't think that we would ask them to do that. Fast forward a few days, and we're starting to hear these senior officials, Defense Secretary, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, Martin Dempsey, saying, we cannot defeat ISIS in Iraq without striking it in Syria, because that's its main base of power. And then, as I said, before we started recording this, we got indications that the U.S. may be imminently preparing airstrikes in Syria.
And you had said something also about this resembling a little bit the situation in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, where the idea was to strike in North Vietnam as part of containment.
Right. It's that kind of debate about should you contain a problem or should you cut it off at the source? And obviously, if you can cut it off at the source, that's better than containment. But if you can't cut it off at the source because the cost is just too high, which is the original reason that the containment doctrine was created, you got to work with containment as far as you can. But then even that, sometimes you got to say, as we eventually did with Vietnam, say, this just isn't working. We've got to leave the situation.
Right. And I think that, I mean, as listeners may recall, last year, I was sort of interested in I was willing to consider intervention, U.S. intervention, as a potential way to prevent a human rights crisis and ethnic cleansing in Syria. My position has definitely shifted, especially now when it seems like there's pretty much no way to win in that regard. I mean, I don't think that at this point, I don't think that the rebel forces have much of a chance. I think that we're looking at Assad versus ISIS, and that's the main conflict as we speak. There's no side in that scenario that is not actively committing those acts.
Right. And that's the problem that we run into every time, which is winnability has to be part of the calculation before you get involved. Because I think that if we start airstrikes, even if they're just against ISIS rather than the Syrian regime, which 52 weeks ago was what we were talking about with the possibility of U.S. airstrikes and missile strikes in response to the chemical weapons attack, even if it's just ISIS, that's a real slippery slope. You know, where do you stop with those attacks? What if you accidentally hit a government position and then now you're potentially at war with the government of Syria? Once we open that door to involvement in Syria, where do we draw the line? So far, we've been able to draw the line quite easily because short of giving weapons out, and even that we haven't done as much as has been claimed or suggested, right? I mean, it's a significant amount, but it hasn't been huge. Certainly not as much as those rebel groups wanted. We drew the line as saying, we're not going in. they came pretty close to going across that line after the sort of red line violation with the chemical weapons attack last year, but the UK Parliament said no. Congress was very imminently going to say no in all likelihood. The American public was very clearly opposed to getting involved in Syria. And maybe that calculation has changed a little bit with the situation in Iraq, but contrary to the whole Republican crowing about, well, Obama shouldn't have taken us out of Iraq, that was such a bad idea that he had, the reason we got out of Iraq was because the American people wanted us out of Iraq. That's been true since 2005 or 2006, and that hasn't changed. There's not a lot of, you know, reverse buyer's remorse going on, withdrawal remorse. It's the same thing with Vietnam. I don't think there were a lot of Americans after South Vietnam fell going, well, we really should have stayed forever and ever in South Vietnam. You know, sometimes you get lucky with like the Korean War, where South Korea had almost completely fallen. Then, you know, we pushed it back all the way almost to the border of China, then got pushed back, and it ended up being kind of almost exactly where it had started. But that was relative to the fact that when the US and UN forces intervened, South Korea had almost been completely destroyed at that point and overrun. If you can contain a situation like that, great, go for it. But sometimes containment is too expensive, and a lot of times going after the source is a lot more expensive than even the containment. I mean, that's the thing with the Vietnam example that you're bringing up. One of the reasons that we never really were able to win in Vietnam was because, and I don't know if it would have been possible anyway, but we never really committed to invading North Vietnam and trying to topple the regime there. We did a lot of airstrikes that basically accomplished nothing, and that's my worry here, but we never committed to going all the way in. And again, I don't think that was an argument for us doing that in Vietnam. That's probably an argument for us having not gotten involved in the first place. But I think winnability and commitment to going all the way, if you have to, has to be a consideration. You can't take this step by step. And that's what I really worry about here with the US policy, is if you open that door to little airstrikes here and there in Syria, it's going to be a lot easier to push for further actions. Keep that ball rolling. Keep going. What if we take out ISIS in eastern Syria? Well, now we've opened the door for, you know, the Assad regime to sweep back into eastern Syria, which has very tenuous relationship with ISIS as it is. And they might not like the Assad regime, but the longer that ISIS is there, the more happy they're going to be with being, quote unquote, liberated by the oppressive regime than by ISIS. I mean, it's probably not a great choice either way. But, you know, that's the reality of it, is if we dislodge and take out ISIS, which seems pretty difficult in eastern Syria, what happens when then, you know, we're held responsible for the Syrian regime that has committed all these acts of ethnic cleansing, sweeping across these Sunni Arab areas again in eastern Syria? We're going to be blamed for having allowed them directly to win instead of just kind of standing by as they sorted out a situation internally. And there's going to be a lot of public pressure, well, not public from the US, but kind of out there pressure from various official sources and the John McCainiac types of saying, we've got to keep going. We've got to keep going all the way. We've got to help the FSA. We've got to take on both ISIS and the Assad regime. Because as the UK government was forced to clarify, you know, oh, we're definitely not going to help the Assad regime. But at a certain point, you know, what are your alternatives? That's as the official in Iraq said, that's the position that they've put the US and NATO and all those folks in, is, are you willing to let ISIS continue to flourish in eastern Syria? Are you going to go it alone, or are you going to, you know, help the Assad regime? You can then look at the alternative. Well, what if we don't get involved at all? I think at that point, what happens now, and we're already starting to see it happen, is that once that third side of the civil war is gone and they let ISIS kind of fight part of their battles for them, they let that continue. That's gone now. That civil war, that part of the civil war in Western Syria is almost over. At this point, it's just going to be ISIS versus Assad. And you know what? 4 years ago, Assad's looking a little iffy. Now, he's looking pretty solid, because he's got these Hezbollah advisors, he's got these Hezbollah forces there. They've been winning lots of battles. The Syrian military, which is very heavily dominated by those minorities who are afraid of just such a regime coming into power, an ISIS-type regime coming into power, they're going to look at that situation and go, okay, well, we've beaten all these other rebels, and, you know, we've got continual weapons supplies coming in from Russia, we've got help coming in from Iran all the time. We can take ISIS. All these other, like the Iraqi army, The Iraqi army's always been incompetent and terrible. They never had a chance of standing up to them. But you know who's just proven themselves for 3 years straight to be able to get out, climb out of that hole, turn things around, and really crack down and take out these cities at all costs? That's the Syrians in the government and the military. So I think at this point, we can just literally sit back and continue to say, this is not our problem anymore. It is our problem in Iraq because we've got direct interests there. Obviously, if the costs become high enough, we're going to say, like we did with South Vietnam, nope, not our problem anymore, because sometimes containment is just too much to sustain. But Syria, that's not our problem. That's still an ongoing massive civil war in a situation that we can't really solve. We can't help them fix that. The side that we like and wanted to win has lost. That war is over for them. This is now just Assad versus ISIS, and that is not our problem. If ISIS somehow manages to defeat the regime, maybe then we can reevaluate and say that's our problem. But again, Syria, regardless of any beheadings, regardless of any ISIS operations, regardless of how Assad does, the facts on the ground don't change. Syria is a very, very adverse environment for a U.S. involvement of any kind on the ground or even in the air. It's going to open up the most gigantic can of worms possible since 2003, maybe even a bigger one than that invasion of Iraq. And we're not going to be able to close that door. It's going to be such a mess. It's going to be a geographic nightmare. We've got no plan to win, even by ourselves. What are we going to do? Run Syria by ourselves? Because there's nobody left to run it after this civil war if we take out the regime there as well. So even if ISIS somehow manages to take Damascus and run the entire country, that's going to be a whole situation. But I suspect that they're going to be very outmatched by the Syrian government and also be facing a massive insurgency by the minorities who were in the regime if the regime falls, because they're not going to want to be under ISIS rule. You know, we're looking at a situation where it's like, this is Assad's problem now. This is not our problem. We don't need to help him, but we don't need to do anything either.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's really no, at this point, there's really no chance of U.S. involvement being a positive thing for, you know, Syrians that are currently being the most affected by this violence. I don't think that it will help at all to go in there and pick one oppressive and genocidal and generally horrible group over another. I don't think that's going to help the average Syrian citizen, and I don't think it's going to be a good thing. So there's that side of it. And then there's the fact that involvement, it would be a huge drain on our own resources. And I really think that most people in the U.S. are pretty sick of military intervention at this point.
That's an excellent point. We're going to get blamed no matter what we do in this situation. Let's pick the option where we're going to do the least damage and spend the least amount of money, right? Don't pick the option where we're going to cause a whole lot of problems and probably not fix anything, but also spend a huge amount of money and lives. That was the mistake with Iraq. I mean, among many mistakes with Iraq. Because as I've said so many times with the Syrian situation, even if you support an active role for the United States in, you know, humanitarian situations and things like that, which doesn't look like that's what we're doing based on the situations in like Central African Republic, for example, even if you think that that is the way you want to go, a U.S. that intervenes everywhere pretty quickly can't intervene anywhere. It's really as simple as that. And the more we intervene, you know, kind of picking and choosing, the more we're going to take some pretty serious flack for, you know, always helping the Sunnis or always helping the Arabs or, you know, whatever. Everyone who doesn't get the help is going to be saying, well, why does the U.S. always support that side? You know, why aren't they helping the 20,000 Turkmens in Amirli in Iraq who are also besieged by ISIS? Well, the Kurds don't really consider them a priority, and we listen to what the Kurds want. So, you know, are we just there to help the Kurds in Syria? Are we just there to help the Arabs, even if the Arabs end up supporting, you know, ISIS or whatever? Are we just, you know, helping the Sunnis? You know, is the Arab Spring, is that only for Sunnis? You know, we didn't do anything in Bahrain. I mean, again, there's lots of reasons why we didn't that are perfectly valid and really solid reasons, but that's the criticism that's been raised. That's not me making that up. That's other people have asked this many times. And so the more places that we intervene without a really solid plan, on top of all the destruction, there's just the fact of like, well, why'd you intervene there and not in this other situation? Especially when some of those other situations, it would have been a lot easier to intervene and do some real good. All right, well, Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Persephone, and joining me on the line from Chicago is freelance writer Jamie Nesbitt Golden. Jamie, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So last week we did a whole bunch of discussion, the whole hour, in fact, about the situation in Ferguson and the National Moment of Silence event in Chicago. One of your podcasting colleagues was on the line for that second segment. You went down from Chicago to see what was going on in Ferguson and see how you could help the situation there. Has that mostly subsided at this point, or is there still kind of activity going on? Because you're back now up in Illinois, but what's going on down there?
Well, the number of protesters have thinned out a bit. So now the focus is sort of, you know, the aftercare. Children will be resuming school tomorrow, having, you know, been postponed for a week. So now it's a matter of making sure they're okay and sort of tending to folks who have, you know, experienced trauma while on the front lines and sort of, you know, healing while still fighting to get answers from Ferguson PD and local and state officials.
Now, if I remember correctly from following your reports on Twitter, you went down after that first crackdown, the first really big crackdown, right? That was the one where they accidentally arrested those journalists and then kind of decided after that it was cool to arrest journalists.
Yeah, I did. And not as a reporter, but as just as a concerned citizen, I hopped a Greyhound with supplies to get to the protesters. Because at that point, they needed toiletries and water and sandwiches. And so I hopped down and spent last weekend there and narrowly missed being tear gassed. And it, you know, words sort of fail me because it's one thing to watch it on a live stream or to see it on a news network. But it's quite another to actually be in the thick of it and to watch people that you've marched with during the day get gassed at night. And these are folks who, you know, aren't activists. They are just normal citizens who just want to be able to exist without having the fear of being gunned down. And it's very surreal. And it's sometimes you walk down West Florissant, which has been sort of the setting for most of these showdowns, and you feel like you're in a Michael Bay film. It's, you know, so this really weird post-apocalyptic feel. You can't believe this is happening, but it's real, and it's really hard to articulate.
Were you there mostly participating in the stuff that was going on in the day, which, as I understand from AMA, tended to be pretty much peaceful across the board, or were you also there during some of the events at night?
I was mostly there during the day. I did stay Saturday last week when the curfew was imposed. I and a few of my friends went to get, you know, gas masks and supplies for folks who were going to be out there. And most of them are, you know, young kids. We're talking late teens, early 20s, who, again, are not activists, who don't know what to do when they get tear gassed or arrested. So we wanted to support them. And thankfully, I think the weather sort of quelled the crowd. So by the time we did get out there, most of the kids had gone, but there were still a decent sized group left. And that was the group that got attacked later on that night.
Now, Jamie, this was something that seems to have, I mean, the protests did sort of develop organically, but was there any organization that you saw happening sort of after the fact? What kinds of structures happened with the group? I mean, I know from what you were describing, you know, there was a lot of support, you know, people were supporting each other, but were there any sort of structural developments?
Not exactly. Well, in terms of, I guess, like sort of grassroots organic orgs being born, there was one, Operation Helper Hush, which was started, I believe, by folks who weren't residents, but there was some involvement from local residents. And that was pretty much support for the protesters who, you know, needed immediate care and their necessities. There was OBS, which is Organization for Black Struggle, who was also on the ground helping out. And I believe Organized Mo was also present, but, you know, just, again, lending help to supporters, not necessarily taking the charge on things. That was mostly left to local clergy, some of whom stepped up and decided to, you know, take the lead on organizing marches and demonstrations.
Now, you mentioned the curfew, and that was something that I had asked you about when you were down there. And I asked you about this on Twitter, and you said that there was sort of a big difference of opinion on whether or not the curfew should be respected among the actual folks there. And that also, you know, I want to ask you about that, but also dovetail into that issue of the so-called outside agitators, which that's a pretty loaded term because it calls back to 1950s and 1960s civil rights era stuff where that was thrown out by the white folks to say, oh, well, these aren't, you know, these aren't the local black folks. These are the outsiders, and our black folks are okay with this. What was... You know, but that was also being used in this situation by some of the actual residents of saying that, especially the white participants who were agitating. What was the dynamic there? I mean, was there a support for continuing these protests, or was there a fear that this was going to be kind of co-opted in some way?
There's a little bit of both. There are people who are, there are residents who are very adamant about keeping up the fight. And going back to the curfew issue, some felt that it was a bit unreasonable because this is their life and this is their town. They shouldn't be ordered, you know, when to stay and when to, you know, go. And there's a lot of concern about third shift workers or second shift workers coming in from work and you know, being unable to get home because of the blockades and the curfews. So there are a lot of different issues at play there. But going back to the outside agitators, a lot of the elevated actions were usually from people who were from out of town and maybe tied to anarchist groups. And it was, the residents, for the most part, were peaceful, you know, sort of adhered to the rules that were given to them, which, again, kind of crazy considering the fact that it's supposed to be, you know, one of their rights to peacefully assemble and protest. But for the most part, again, most agitators were from other areas. There was actually a group out of Chicago, I can't remember the name offhand, that had come down. And I think a couple of their members were arrested. And at some point during one of the protests, residents themselves would weed out people who looked suspicious and hand them over to police. So, I mean, they were really adamant about keeping it peaceful. But, you know, and then there's another component with the younger crowd. And you know, it is a different feel at night because most of the older folks have gone home with their kids. And you have, again, these teenagers who have years of experience of being harassed by the local law enforcement there. And they feel like they have nothing to lose. And they're ready to literally die for the cause. And it's heartbreaking. So, yeah, all of those elements have been present there in the last couple weeks.
Right. There was a Newsweek report looking at a study that was released by a local pro bono legal defense group from based in St. Louis. And they found that although this was, you know, true across most of the communities in St. Louis County and the city of St. Louis, Ferguson in particular was especially notorious for having such high levels of police stoppage or effectively harassment that basically every single person, or at least black person in Ferguson, had been stopped by the cops at least once, because this was, you know, just like based on the numbers that had to have happened because they were using the police department as their number two source of revenue for the community. So obviously there's a lot of, you know, built up resentment there locally. But from the outside perspective, setting aside the problematic, you know, white anarchist groups who are there to fight the government rather than fight injustice to black Americans. You know, you were someone who was coming in from the outside. So from that perspective, how much of this do you think should be or should have been something that was local versus a sort of solidarity from saying this is bigger than Ferguson, this is a nationwide problem?
Yeah, it's so complicated, right? Because don't want to overstep. And I think I feel, you know, talking to a few of the residents this weekend, they are, you know, sort of overwhelmed by national attention and the celebrities, the various celebrities to Ferguson. I want to say that it should be, in theory, should be a local issue. It should be something between the residents and local officials. The problem is they don't have, I suppose, the resources to sort of take these folks on. And that's where a lot of people are coming in. So you have folks like the NAACP, you have Dream Defenders, you have Color of Change, you have all of these, you know, networks lending a hand. And I think the important thing is throughout all of this is to continue to listen to the needs of the residents and not so much try to take the lead on things, but to provide support and, you know, direction if necessary, but not to, again, take things over. And I think that's the general fear that, you know, the outsiders will sort of come in and try to take over. And of course, that makes a lot of folks down there sort of wary and apprehensive, and they have every right to be. Like, I was talking to a member of OBS a couple days ago, and she's, you know, telling me that, well, you know, this is great and all, you know, but you know, when people come down here offering tons of unsolicited advice, they can't help but laugh because, you know, they, you know, like, you haven't been down here. Like, we've been down here. We live, this is our life, you know, this is our life. And you can't necessarily come down here and tell us things that we already know. It doesn't really help much. And I mean, that's what they've been, you know, sort of experiencing for the most part.
So maybe some trainings of how to follow all the laws to the extent possible with these protests, or know when that line has been crossed for the purposes of civil disobedience. That's sort of an advisory thing.
Yeah, and I mean, and to that end, there have been organizations that are helping residents learn how to peacefully protest, how to mount a campaign against certain officials. You know, so they're learning all these valuable things, and that's, you know, and that's perfectly fine. I mean, they're happy that that's happening, but, you know, they also want folks to keep in mind that they are also able to lead the charge if they have to.
Right. Now, one of the other things that came up, and, you know, a lot of this was very well intentioned from your friends and family, was concern about you going down there as a parent, that you have a child to worry about back home. And you had sort of responded publicly about why you thought that it was important to go down because of that, not despite it. I was wondering if you could kind of shed a little bit of light on that.
Sure. So in the Black community, we always talk about the talk, and, you know, it's not the sex talk. It's the how to handle yourself if you're ever stopped by the police talk. And growing up, I was fortunate to not have as many negative experiences with the cops. But for folks like my husband, for other Black folks, I know my experience is pretty much an anomaly. And raising a Black son, these are things you have to be prepared for. So I, you know, I feel that in order to at least attempt to change the way Black men are treated by law enforcement, in order to help sort of keep the issue of police brutality at the forefront, me going down there was necessary. And lending, you know, my support and listening to folks and doing what I could just as my part as a citizen, it was important. I'm not sure if things will be different 10 or 15 years from now. I want to say maybe, but I'm just way too jaded to think that they will be different. But, you know, I work despite that. I still work in spite of whatever may happen. I know I'm getting really rambly, but, like, I mean, it's been a really emotional couple weeks, and the things that you see, the way police treat the residents is, I mean, without a doubt, reprehensible. You definitely get the idea that you're in a time warp when you go down. And that's a future that I just can't see for my son. And that's why I go down, and that's why I help. So
after the initial major issues with police attacks on protesters, there was the sort of brief period of, you know, positive interactions and then back to the negative. When you have that kind of sort of turn where it looks like it's going better and then it just becomes completely destructive again, do you think that there's really any way to resolve the specific issues of how police are handling protesters? Or do you think that that's just something that's just, there's not going to be any resolution to?
I would say in order for trust to be restored, there would have to be some widespread structural changes. Like, recently there was a report that several Ferguson cops were suspended for various infractions, which, you know, I think were mostly like harassment of citizens and racial profiling. And it's one thing to, you know, to put these cops on suspension and sort of keep the rest of them employed and working and sort of doing what they've been doing for the longest time. So in order to restore that trust, there will have to be some punishment, one, for Officer Wilson. I feel that would be first and foremost. And then sort of dismantling the Ferguson PD and rebuilding it with more police officers of color, more officers who have been psychologically evaluated, because I think that's also important. That's also an important piece that's been left out. A lot of these cops are not balanced and have issues themselves, and that spills over into their work. And, you know, you can have all the sensitivity trainings in the world, but that doesn't cure what's really ailing them. So you have to make sure that these folks that you give badges and guns to know how to talk to the public, know how to relate to the public, know how to de-escalate a situation, know what a true conflict resolution tactic is. These are all important things. And in order for the residents and local officials to get to a place of healing, these things have to happen. Will they happen? I am not sure at all. You get the idea that a lot of folks in power down there just want this to be over with. Not necessarily coming to a peaceful resolution, but, you know, just to shut the folks up or to, you know, continue to sweep everything under the rug and just push past. And that's not going to happen. I think these residents are in it for the long haul. And if they don't get what they want, I shudder to think what will happen. I really do.
All excellent points. I think actually some of the other communities, or at least one in the St. Louis County area, have actually had to dismantle their entire police forces from top to bottom for mm-hmm. various similar things. So it's the question of, I guess, you know, are they going to go through and do a systematic overhaul here, or are they just trying to basically suppress this situation and then mm-hmm. move on with nothing changed?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, we're about out of time here, but Jamie Nesbitt-Golden, freelance writer, where can people find out more about you and your work and follow you and see what you've got to say on various things?
Okay. Well, I am on Twitter at The Way of the Id. I am also one half of hoodfeminism.com, which I run with my good friend Mickey Kendall, also known as Carnethia, on Twitter. And I geek out at nerdgasmnoir.net.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show this week to talk to us about what you've seen firsthand down there in Ferguson and why this is so important.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.